mind, speech and mind in their natural state. So the body is still, relaxed, at ease, but alert. Speech is quiet. We're not obviously speaking on the outer world, but also speech in terms of what is going on in the way that we're talking to ourselves. And like we talked about, there's always a narrative, a frequently narrative, where we're chattering away. And as we quiet our minds, we can find more and more subtle levels of that. So it can begin to settle back to its natural state, which is a clear, quiet, present mind. And mind, same with thoughts. And actually thoughts and mental factors, which are always arising, and we begin to send them into a deep, deep sense of still, present mind, pristine awareness. So that's where we're headed. So begin again, as always, by bringing your awareness, disengaging from what is surrounding us with so much stimuli. And arriving here in the present moment through feeling the physical, tactile sensations of being embodied. And especially, we can bring our awareness into this experience of solidity and firmness where our body is in contact with the ground. Simply being aware of these tactile sensations of firmness and solidity, where your body is in any type of contact, the ground, with the chair, grounding our awareness, releasing it into the earth. And then allow your awareness to begin to slowly rise up through your body, noting any kind of physical tactile sensations wherever you encounter them. Maybe pressure, pain, tension, feelings of contraction. Maybe the feeling of air, temperature, movement, kind of a tingling. And noting the bare attention to the physical, tactile, visceral sensations as your awareness begins to drift up through your body, up towards the crown of your head. And as you bring your awareness up through to the crown of your head, you can feel almost the lifting of the crown of your head up towards the sky, releasing into the great sky father energy. And now take three deep breaths into your abdomen, locating the feeling, the sensations of the lower belly expanding and releasing as you inhale, and the diaphragm lifting, and then finally the chest expanding. And then effortlessly releasing the breath. And as you take these three long, deep, full breaths, being mindfully aware of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire body. Now bringing awareness to the abdomen alone, allowing the breath to settle into its natural rhythm. Allowing the inhalation to flow in without any attempt to control it. The exhalation to release naturally, letting go all the way through to the end of the out-breath, where the natural, maybe even spontaneous turn of the breath occurs, and allowing that next breath to flow in effortlessly like a wave washing up on the shore. The breath is breathing itself this way while we allow our awareness to rest 100% on the felt, physical, tactile sensations of the breath in the abdomen. And allowing body, speech, and mind to settle into its natural state. In the present moment awareness, relaxed and vivid. So if you notice that your mind waters or wanders, or that the inner voice begins to chatter with a story, rejoice that you caught it, that you're lucid. Releasing your grasp on that object, letting it go, making that choice to let it go, and returning to the meditation object of the felt, tactile, physical sensations. And focusing on the physical sensations of the breath at the abdomen. Okay. So we'll start, as always, by turning around, saying hi to someone near you, and introducing yourself if you don't know them. Okay, does anyone remember the homework from last week? Yes. I see a finger coming up.
I had a little test, so I looked at it like every day.
Uh-huh.
And it was asking myself questions on each action. And if the action, if I was being authentic to each action.
Yeah.
And so I kind of journaled like mini paragraphs of each one.
Oh, cool. How was it?
I wish I had the list on. The beginning of it was fine. Mm-hmm. But then when I got to the lower ones, I felt really lost in that.
Okay. Good. Great. Thank you. Yeah, it's great.
Like, just I'm lost here.
Right. How about anybody else? Thoughts about last week's class? Anything? What stayed with you? Maybe nothing. That's okay. Yeah.
Was that last week? Oh, was it 2 weeks ago?
It was last week.
Sorry.
I think we had a holiday in between. Is that part of what happened? Is everyone still on a holiday mind break?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do a quick review. Bring us back up. So we did our meditation, and what we talked about to begin with was the Four Noble Truths. Right? That life sucks, and this is why, and you can change it, and this is how. And it talked about the Buddha described the ways that life sucks, the physical and mental suffering that we have. And he broke it down into birth because he was very aware of the pain of birth, the just pain of coming into a new incarnation, basically. And then sickness, which we all, I believe, at this point in our lives have probably experienced, old age, which I'm noticing. I have a lot of friends that are maybe 10, 15 years older than I am, and I still think of us all being young, right? Or younger, anyway. And recently, I saw someone that I hadn't seen for a while. We were going for a walk, and it was like, she couldn't walk along the rocks because of her knees hurting, and she couldn't walk down the path to the path in the place where we usually do because it was unsteady. I thought, oh yeah, this is the declining of the body, right? This is getting old. And we had a family reunion. My nephew graduated high school, so I spent time in that situation with everybody, and my older half-brother is 10 years older than I am, and I still think of him as like being, I remember, my first memory of him is when I was about 2 or 3, so he was a young teenager, and I still have this vivid memory of him. And when I look at him, it would be like this weird kind of double vision, because I would see him that way, and then suddenly I would see, no, wait, he's actually this almost 70-year-old guy. And it would shock me, because superimposed on that is still my vision of him as this young person that I knew and grew up with. You know? So the part of why we talk about the noble truths, or the truths of the noble ones, the four truths that people awaken to, is you think, well, yeah, it's obvious, but we keep these things at bay. We just don't really look and see that aging, and let alone our death, right? We did. And some of us in this room participated in a program for a year called A Year to Live, where it was all about just coming to look at the fact that we're going to die and prepare for a death. Basically, it was picking a death day a year ahead, and then meeting every month, and coming and doing some work towards that, getting ready for that day of our death. It was pretty amazing and intense, because it's always like, no, no, not me. And then the second truth is that when we look more deeply, we see this dukkha, this suffering, this unease, this dissatisfaction, this restlessness pervades all of our lives, right? Every facet and every part of our life where we don't see it correctly, we think that things are going to last, but then they change. And we think there's a real self-existent self, and this thing is real, but we don't see the interdependence, and so we suffer because we don't see that we all exist interdependently, right? And that we don't have any core self-existing substance. And the third truth is the good news, right? The good news, there is good news, that we can stop our suffering. It really can. We can transform ourselves in the world. An awakening is possible. So then the question is, well, how? And this is what we're on now, the path to end our suffering, which is always boils down to wisdom and compassion, the trainings in wisdom and compassion, which also can boil down in our Mahayana tradition as our major goal, the goal that is what we all align our lives with, is to alleviate the suffering, to ultimately end the suffering of ourselves and others by waking up, to waking up to reality. Waking up in reality is probably more appropriately to say than to, from it. It's not like waking up from a dream, it's we wake up to the dream, in the dream.
Are there, when you look at like the different scopes, is like the great scope, is that the quality would be compassion, and the middle scope would be wisdom, and maybe ethics, or would the small scope just be ethics? Something. Is there kind of qualities tied to each?
Well, with the three, I mean, you could, I would say actually that when you look at it, they're all in each and every one of the scopes, but then the scope is how. I mean, in terms of the three higher trainings. But the trainings are that we're talking about are ethical conduct, meditation, or concentration and wisdom. And then the three scopes he's asking about are the scope where your concern, and this is kind of what we're going to get to with intention, is just trying to have a better life. Like, trying, and really you're not a Buddhist until you say trying to have a better rebirth, like orienting your life so that this life is better and next life is better, right? To get to, and then the next scope is to recognize that, wait, there is no better life, right? That every incarnation in samsara, in the suffering world, is full of suffering. And so really what we need to do is, I want to get out of suffering altogether. For me, myself, and I. And then greater scope is when you recognize, wait, suffering's universal. It's not just me, it's everybody's suffering. So I need to reach enlightenment as quickly as possible for the sake of every living being. Does that make sense to that? So when you can train in all three, but you're training with the intention or the motivation, different motivation. Did that answer your question? So the three, and then the three trainings are, again, ethical conduct and meditation and wisdom. So underlying all this, we talk about genuine happiness or sukha and dukkha, which is suffering. And I thought it would be interesting to go back and look at the etiology of those words. So ka literally means the hub of a wheel. So if you imagine a wheel, it's like the hub. And then sukha means a wheel that's turning and going along very sweetly and satisfactorily and going well. And then dukkha is like a tire that's gone flat and it's kind of bumping along and not actually working very well, right? And so I like that, that sense of what's working, what's going, really turning sweetly and kind of in an upward spiral versus what's not working, and we're just kind of driving this car along with the tires flat bumping along the road, and it's not going smoothly. So we talked about the three higher trainings, and then we talked about the Eightfold Path and how they map on to the three higher trainings, right? So there's a little confusion sometimes here. I mentioned that we talk about the Eightfold Path as being, in one way, a path that you can talk about linearly that begins with right view or right understanding and goes around. But I like this visual of it being more of a wheel with the hub of the Buddhist the Buddhist intention, really. And so this is one that is going to turn out to, so our lives and future lives and all lives actually run smoothly, and ultimately we awaken and are liberated from suffering altogether. And so there's a little bit of confusion sometimes because the order switches when we talk about the path in terms of this is the order we're going to talk about it in, which is the three higher trainings actually switch because we talk about wisdom and then ethics and then concentration. And the reason why is that, well, a couple things. One, again, the Eightfold Path, the eight paths don't need to actually be followed sequentially one after another. That they can be more like considered components than steps, like comparable to, someone used this example of intertwining strands of a single cable that requires the contributions of all those cables, all those little strands. And I was thinking of this on the Golden Gate Bridge because I used to drive over the Golden Gate Bridge all the time. And I would look and see those cables and think about all the little fibers that are holding together, and that these fibers, then, like, they're basically holding up the bridge in a certain way. It's just wild when you think about it. And so it's that same thing, that one fiber wouldn't do it alone, but when you intertwine them all together, it creates something that's really got strong. And so that way, all of the eight factors are together, interweaving, present simultaneously, and supporting each other. Now, until we reach that point, we need to actually develop them kind of sequentially, right? So we need to, if we just try to develop all at once and we don't really know what they are, and you like get to eight, you're like, whoa, I don't know, I don't understand this at all, and can't even make anything up. So we go through them sequentially so that we can build on them until we get to that point where they're all realized in our being and we can intertwine them. So what we begin with is we begin with wisdom because we need an entry point of wisdom to either even decide that we want to be on the path. So in a funny way, you could say wisdom is both the beginning and the culmination of the path. It's what gets, there's some right view that begins to get us onto the path and walking the path, and right aspiration or intention. And then it's also going to be the culmination, which again takes us back to this sense it's a wheel. It's not just we get up to here and we get to go on permanent vacation, right? It's not like that. It's more like the Buddha put it this way. He said, we're looking for a true refuge, a shelter, a place to rest and be at ease. People threatened by fear go to many refuges, to mountains, forests, parks, trees, and shrines. None of these is a secure refuge. None is the supreme refuge. Not by going to such a refuge is one released from all suffering. But when someone going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha sees with right insight the Four Noble Truths, suffering, the rising of suffering, the overcoming of suffering, and the Eightfold Path leading to the end of suffering. This is the secure refuge. This is the supreme refuge. By going to such a refuge, one is released from all suffering. And I love that image of a true refuge. And that's what I feel like sometimes in the middle of my days. Just give me a true refuge, a moment's inner peace, please. So we begin with right view, right understanding. So right away, the image that appealed to me is like right, left, right, wrong. So the idea here is not like right, wrong. Again, we get to these words that come into us in English, but this is more like complete, or the translation I recently ran across was harmonious, which I really like, the one that's harmonious and brings us into harmony. And then view here, what is a view? It's not like a belief, okay, or a creed that you have to live by. It means more like an orientation, really, right? An understanding. It's another way that it's often translated. A perspective that we can take on for our purpose of finding the path and watching and walking the path. But then this idea of orientation, like what are our held views? And when we think about it, behind almost everything behind everything we do, there is an orientation. There are views that we hold. And the thing is that a lot of them aren't self-conscious, right? Their basis, they're the underpinnings. Somebody once said, if you think you don't have a philosophy, you just have a bad philosophy. Because we all have a philosophy and values and things and views that we hold. That one of the translations, again, that I like is worldviews, how we view the world. And they're the perspectives, the beliefs, the filters that we run things through in order to understand our world and ourself. And then the thing is, and why they're so important, is they're the basis by which we make our choices moment to moment. And the problem is when we don't see them as our view and we don't understand that there are our perspective, we often just think this is the world, the way the world is. We don't even realize we have glasses on it's like the typical, the cliche of the rose-colored glasses, and you walk around and and now we would use contacts, right? You have rose-colored contacts in, and you're looking at the world, and everything looks rosy, and everything's kind of has a pinkish hue, and you believe that's just the reality of the world, that it is that way. So part of the great value of right view is just to begin to even understand that we have a view. And so one of the questions that, again, in terms of what could essentially transform and bring awareness to our lives, is to begin to ask this question, what are my views? What are my held beliefs and assumptions about the world that I've maybe never have looked at? Okay. Like, to me, this really seems solid, let alone this. Because when I hit this on this, this is what kind of goes ouch and gives way. So, but if Jenny were here, and who studies and bases her whole work on physics, she would say, when you look deeply, this isn't solid. There is no solidity to that. Which reminds me of that old joke that I love to why does the physicist why does the physicist wear big fluffy slippers? Because they're afraid of falling between falling through the spaces between atoms. Right? So they begin to go, and their worldview now is that this isn't solid. And the spaces, they understand that the spaces in this thing that we call solid are actually greater than the atoms, the space that the atom takes up. Okay. How did I get off on that? Because really, right view, looking at our held beliefs, that's right. And the whole idea with right view is it's not a belief. It's got to come to us through a very pragmatic way that it shows, and we test it, that it brings us to an alignment with the path to freedom, right? So Buddhism emphasizes two forms of right view. One is a standpoint that we do say, think, does not exist in a vacuum, right? That these have physical and psychological and emotional consequences. And those are related to their ethical nature. So if what we see, think, and do is based on what's called greed, hate, and ignorance, then the consequences are going to be harmful. And if they're based on generosity and kindness and wisdom, then the consequences are going to be beneficial. So I think that that is one that, again, we could take home and just begin to test in our own lives. Because if we can begin to see directly, again, it's not about beliefs, but this is all about what can we bring in our own lives. So the more that we live by this view that generosity and kindness will bring us more beneficial, happy-making, peaceful, easeful, connecting consequences, then the more likely we are to speak, think, and act in ways that bring ourselves, right, generosity, kindness, and also that for others. So the second worldview or right view is the perspective of the Four Noble Truths, which is basically, again, bringing us to the understanding that ultimately we really want to orient our lives around this understanding that brings us to freedom and happiness, and genuine happiness. Okay, so the idea here with the right view is it's actually the first part of the path, because it brings us onto the path to liberation. And there's one metaphor that the Buddha uses a lot. He likes to tell the story of a hunter. And the hunter goes out into the forests around, and you have to imagine that we're living in a world that isn't like this. It's a world where you have a tiny little town or village, and then it's surrounded by massive space, and it's all wild space. And I have this real vision of this, or view of this right now, because we live by the river, like I like to mention, and you guys notice how high the rivers were this winter. And so what they did was all of our walking paths were just became completely covered by water. And the water was all coming this way and carrying all the stuff down it and moving logs and all the debris and carrying it with it. So now the water's gone down, and all the places that we could walk, especially what we like to call the island, because in the winter it's an island and in the summer it becomes a peninsula, all of a sudden we can finally walk on it again. So I was out there looking at trying to walk on the paths, and the paths, I couldn't even find them because there's so many fallen trees and debris, and the actual landscape has changed. And I was thinking about this metaphor because suddenly I don't know where the path is. I don't even know that a path exists on the other side of that fallen log, right? So the hunter goes out into the woods like this, where there is no path. And then he comes back and he talks about, and he says, when I was out there and I went enough through this debris, I found a path. And I walked along this path and it led to this forgotten kingdom, right? And in the forgotten kingdom were this shining royalty. And so the Buddha then likened and said that this is what the spiritual liberation, the path of spiritual liberation is like. It's like a long forgotten path, deep in the forest, overgrown with trees, and then you find it. And then you begin to walk it, and you find yourself in that inner castle, because he says the castle and they have it, the royalty is actually us, once we find our way back to being that golden Buddha that was all covered up with crap that we talked about last time. And then he compares that dense undergrowth of the forest to all of our mental and emotional obstacles that are constraining our freedom. and talks about then that we all have our inner dangers and challenges, but we also have within ourselves what it takes to find the path and walk the path, right? So what that means is that right view is this encouraging perspective that there is a path. And that when we discover the path, that we have a sense that the path is going to lead us to where we want to go. And this is kind of cycling back to what we talked about, but this is before a little bit about finding the path. But the idea here is that if we want to understand the path, it means that we have to be able to then have the understanding that both the path and the obstacles are within us. And so what we're working with is it requires us to really, you know, take responsibility for the way that we view the world and how much it's in accordance with reality and how much it's not. So seeing reality clearly includes, first of all, the Four Noble Truths. And then what the Buddha really emphasized in this part of his teachings was what you want to be understanding most of all and exploring most of all is the true causes of things, which is karma, which is what the Wednesday night class has been on. So some of you have been taking that. So what are your understandings of karma, those of you who haven't been in the class? Like if you just kind of, what are you walking in with your understanding of karma's meaning?
I see it like an echo.
What's that?
Like an echo.
An echo? Mm-hmm. Can you say more?
What you give out comes back towards you.
Yeah. What you give out comes back towards you. Cool. And that's actually a metaphor that's often used. It's an echo. It's like when you shout down, hello, then you get hello, hello, hello back, right? And it's actually a very apt metaphor because usually it's just one hello and you get many hellos back. And that's one of the laws of karma is that it multiplies. So whatever you plant, or maybe whatever you put out there, it comes back to you actually. What else? Like, what's your feeling about karma? Is it something that's a, if you just even think of it as like, oh my God, it's retribution and it's, or maybe it's even, I don't know anything about it.
I think a lot of times karma is perceived as the negative effect. You know, I like people pass you and cut you off, like you talk about a lot. And uh-huh. I think, you know, some might think, pass them on the street, and their tire came off their car, so they had to pull over. Now, you know, oh, how did your speeding work? Well, there's karma, buddy, as you're passing them and you're
right.
taking. So I'm like really afraid to be negative. I'm afraid to dwell in negativity or be an extremely negative person because I. And it's not just a karma belief. I just have this belief that I'm going to attract,
mm-hmm.
right? So what I put out there, it's going to come back to me, which is kind of like the echo. So it's kind of like a, what do they call that? I'm kind of afraid. It's one of my fears is, mm-hmm. and it has been since I was a little girl, being mean to someone or being hurtful. That I just always want to try to exude positivity because I think that it'll come back. So I don't think of karma necessarily always as that negative. I also kind of take it in that it's also the positive.
Right.
So when I give back to help someone in need or just whether they're asking for it or not, I see that someone needs help, that I'll get that back. And I don't think like when something great's happening, I don't go, oh yes, that's because I got the mayonnaise down for that little short lady in the aisle. It's not those things. Mm-hmm. It's more just my overall, you know, what I like to get out.
Cool. So what I'm hearing you really is talking about is the positive and negative aspect of karma, right? Like that some, that you can plant, you can put out the positive, something yeah. positive, and it's going to come back
yeah.
positively.
More, I'm afraid if I put out
and but also that fear, if I put out something yeah. negative, negatives come back,
yeah.
which is great, because there's another law of karma, which is you reap what you sow, right? If you put out something negative, if you plant negative, you get back negative. If you plant positive, you get back positive. Right? Anybody else to pipe into this?
Also that it's on you. It's
uh-huh.
on you. Like, I can't give my karma to somebody else, nor can someone else ever give it to me.
Yeah, so there's a personal responsibility there. Like, I can't give you my good karma or my negative karma. I can't dump all my negative karma on you
no.
and take all your positive.
Right. It's not like Monopoly or something.
Right. Yeah. So some way it seems to be really about, there's a personal responsibility there and a personal, yeah. Cool. And that's what the Buddhists say is it's carried in a mind stream. Right? So when we say mind in Buddhism, it's not these thoughts. It's really this continuing energy, if you want to say it, of who we are. And when we look at who that, what that is, it actually is nothing other than karma. You look like you're, I got something to say.
Eric, think about this sometimes. I had a friend who were discussing this one time, the relationship between modern physics and where karma falls into it. And we had this idea that the things reflected in karma is string theory in a way. And because what happens is we all individually have our own responsibility, and things come to us through a variety, through dependent arising circumstances and whatnot. Things are presented to us. And then at the point that we interact with it, we have our individual volition, which is where ethics come in, is where we make the choice how we respond. And then at the point where we respond, so I could, something can come up and I can just like, and then just vomit out on it, or I can catch my breath, hold that one back, reason through it, and say, well, maybe this person's mother's sick and their dog just died, and it's got nothing to do with me, and then extend some compassion. So that you have, it's more like in the mind stream. It's like rafting in the mind stream, where you have, you know, boulders and things and currents and different choices you can make on a boat in the river, and you can make that within your mind stream as you continue to move forward. And the idea is that if you think also that not only is karma, really is just, it's just action, positive, negative, and those are all qualities that we also imbue into something. So that one person thinks it's a tragedy, someone else sees it as opportunity, as you know, this old saying goes. So the thing that I find very intriguing in trying to remember also is that there comes a point when your mind can be evolved enough that you are no longer generating enough karma. So think of yourself as like you're no longer a mere bouncing stuff back. The silver's all flaked off and you're transparent. But even at the point you're no longer generating, you know, or more karma for one reason or another, you still have past karma that is going to kind of exhaust itself. So you still, it's like you're not feeding the fire anymore, but the fire that's there still has to burn out. And we still have to be careful because if the last embers continue to burn out, there's still opportunities for us to respond to stuff. And so that negative, positive, you know, those are qualities we give it, and that we have our individual, but we collectively, we have karma too. It's a tremendous amount of a net of karma that brings everybody together in this room at this time to sit and think these thoughts and to ponder the stuff. It's really a tremendous thing when you think of how disparate our lives have been that led up to this moment. It's a very
yeah.
awesome thing.
So a couple of things that I'm hearing you say. One is that karma is very complex, and how it not only is it complex, the Buddha said, it's harder to see the workings of karma than it is to see emptiness directly. because that deep of a hidden reality. But the good news is that if we, this is why we study it, is because we can begin to see it at a certain level, and even in our daily lives we can see it. We can already begin to feel it and watch it play out. And karma creates both the experiences we have in our daily life, but also, if you're a Buddhist, it creates our future lives as well. So the question is, the other thing I heard you say is two other things. One is it's volition, and this is what the Buddha taught. He said, when you don't create karma, karma is cause and effect, and everything that we're experiencing is an effect of some cause prior, and it's the cause of what's going to happen to us next, right? And for us in our lives next, in our world of what we experience. And we don't have to worry that as we're driving along and bugs are hitting the windshield, that we're creating tons of negative karma by killing these little bugs, because there isn't a big volitional push behind it. We don't have this, I'm going to go out and kill a million bugs by driving really fast today. It's not like a willpower. It's not a choice we're making, right? And then the other thing that you mentioned really points to the flip side of karma, which is emptiness. And the two of them, you can't really talk about one without talking about the other. So, and the way you talked about it was, you said something about, some people would experience it this way and some people would experience it that way. And this is where I think that it really comes so deeply into play in our lives when we talk about compassionate communication, nonviolent communication, cultivating emotional balance. That is all to talk about this, and this understanding that I am having my experience right now, and that is a valid experience arising out of the causes and conditions of my karma, and the causes that create that karma, and the conditions that are supporting that to ripen. And someone else can be having an exact opposite experience, and they're having a valid experience. They're having their feelings. I can't argue with their feelings. They're experiencing their feelings, right? They are experiencing their needs. They are equally valid. So one of the easiest ways that we've taught this that I love is, so what is this? A pen, right? And if you go like this in front of our little puppy, what's he going to do with it? Chew it, says the animal trainer, the dog trainer. And so what we would say, is this a pen to the dog? No. What is it to the dog? A toy. Something to chew on, right? So what is it to me and you and all of us in this room? A pen. Right? So who's right? Yeah, you could say both, right? To the dog, it's something to chew on, and to the person, it's a pen that we write with. And someone always likes to say, but I like to chew on my pen, right? Yes, but you're either a puppy, or you're someone who likes to chew on a pen, but you've already labeled it and seen it as a pen. You didn't say, I want to chew on my chew toy, which would really make you a puppy, especially if you're wagging your tail as you did it. So, now, if we put this here and we all leave the room and we look around and there are no puppies in the room, so it is now a room devoid of puppies and devoid of human beings, what is it then? Is it a chew toy or is it a pen?
Neither.
Yeah. We couldn't validly say it's either one, right? It's neither one from its own side. This is getting back to one of the truths that we talked about. No inherent existence, right? So because then when a human comes back in the room, they pick up a pen. If a puppy were to come into the room, the puppy would start chewing on their chew toy. Yeah? So if the pen were coming from the pen, right? Well, let's put it this way. Which way is the penness coming? And you can show me. Is it going like this way, or is it this way?
It's talking to us.
Is it talking to us saying, I'm a pen? It's talking to Jeremy saying, I'm a pen, I'm a pen.
And it's coming from our side.
Yeah,
it's
right?
The little button mind.
Because if it wasn't coming from some way we are seeing this as a pen, if it weren't coming from us, if we weren't perceiving it as a pen, then it couldn't be a pen to us and a chew toy to the dog, right? So when the humans come in the room, it's a human perception. When the dogs come into the room, it's a dog perception, right? So what that takes us to is there's got to be something about being a human in our mind, our awareness, that forces us to see it as a pen, and something in the dogs, which forces it to see it as a chew toy. And when it's down here, it's neither. And so that's where we say it's empty. It's empty of being a pen from its own side. Right? So we can run through things. Like, a lot of questions come up about this. Well, then, does that mean that if it's coming as a pen from coming, presenting as a pen from my side and not from the pen side, does that mean I can see it as a stack of $100 bills?
See it that way.
Well, but do you really see it that way? I mean, are you, when this gets held up, do you immediately perceive? So it's coming from my mind, but there's something that's forcing me to see it this way. Because if it wasn't forcing me to see it this way, then I would be able to validly, let's say validly see it. And by validly, like you said, function, that is one of the tests of being a valid perception, is that I could pick it up and start handing you each $100 bills, because I was seeing this as a $100 bill. Now, so that's the question then. What is it that is this little image that arises and says pen? Where is that coming from? And so what we say is that there's the way that it's talked about in a lot of Buddhist texts is that there's a seed, okay, a karmic seed, that is there in our mind stream waiting. Well, I don't know if it's waiting to unfold, but it's available so that when we have all of the causes and conditions that for that seed to ripen, then we are forced to see pen in the present moment. And the dog who comes in is forced to see chew toy in the present moment, right? So is this real? Like, does this actually exist? If I'm saying it's just coming from my mind, does it exist?
Sure.
If you don't think so, come here and I will, draw on you. The dog can chew on it. It's real. I can write with it. It's real. The question is, what do I mean by real, right? I don't mean that it's real self-existing out there. What I mean is it's real because it comes from my mind. It's valid because it comes from my mind. It functions because it comes from my mind, right? So it's there, and it exists. Maybe rather than real, say, does it exist? Yes, it exists, right? And it exists because it's coming from my mind. If it weren't actually coming from my mind as a karmic seed ripening, then the dog would write with it, and I would be chewing on it as a chew toy. Okay, so you guys with me so far? So then the question is, if the karmic seeds in my mind are determining how I experience the world, then is it possible to intentionally plant seeds for how I want to see my future world? Right? Because if I could change the seeds for how I'm going to plant my future garden, then I could transform my future life. And that's the point of karma. It's not that I'm suffering through what I planted, and it's not predeterminism. And, I mean, we're in the Central Valley. There's plants and gardening all around. And I always like to joke that I'm the worst gardener in the world. So I plant my seeds, and then I get these little tomato plants, right? It's like, like this. And Mark plants his seeds, and then they come out these glorious vines that take over the whole backyard and have a ton of tomatoes, right? So the reason for that is because we talk about causes and conditions for these to ripen. So causes and conditions are like, we need the fertilizer. He knows how to fertilize it. He knows how much water to put on it. I always tend to overwater and drown the plants, it turns out. I think I'm just nurturing them, but I'm basically drowning them. You can kill things with too much love, I guess. And then you need the sunshine, so they need to go in the, but not too much sun, so you need to put them in the right place. So those are like creating the causes and conditions for the seeds to ripen. So there are a lot of laws of karma. We already came up with one of them. Like gives rise to like. So I can't plant my watermelon seeds that I spit out after I eat my watermelon and expect to get a tomato plant, right? Or I could, but I'd be really disappointed. Hey, maybe that's what happens when we suffer, right? Not understanding the laws, the way of cause and effect, I'm acting in a certain way that plants seeds for tomato plants, and I really want watermelon, right? So the Buddha said, that we create, that we plant our karmic seeds through our actions, through our words, and through our thoughts. And specifically, this is why there was a whole amazing course on it, because we could spend 8 weeks, 10 weeks, months just meditating and going into this. The question is, what do we need to know to really see it function in our life, right? Like, okay, tell me, this is Buddhism for busy people. I'm one of those busy people. Tell me what I need to know, you know, without a 12-week course. So the biggest ways that we plant our suffering, or we create our suffering, is that we think that there is a pen out there, right? We don't understand that the pen is coming from the karmic seeds that we planted to see a pen. And then we get really confused by why things are happening, and we think they're random. But you know, if you really thought they were random, then you would be seeing, I don't know, donuts raining from the sky and cars that are suddenly flying off here and there in the freeway. I mean, it would just be total chaos. So we know it's not random. So the question is, how do we plant it? So we plant it most strongly in relation to other living beings. So Cheryl is now a student, and she needs to write a paper, and she doesn't have a pen, and she needs to take notes, and I see she doesn't have a pen, and with a lot of concern and generosity in my heart, I hand her a pen. And what that does is it plants a seed, it leaves an imprint on my mind seed stream, which is what's called, sometimes it's called karmic imprint, sometimes they're called karmic seeds. And so when she takes that, and I see myself having given her that pen, then I've created that karmic seed that's going to ripen and forces me in the future to see a pen when I need a pen. And this little, what do I want to call it? Karma recorder is going, functioning all the time. It's seeing our thoughts, our actions, and our words. And I love the story that just about it being on all the time that I love is the story of it was actually a Sufi teacher who was testing his three closest students, and he said, gave them each a goose, and he said, go kill this goose where no one can see you do it, because he's testing their understanding. And the way that, and so I can't, so we're going to learn like what creates a positive seed, what's a negative. But one of the big negative ones
is harming other living beings, right? In any way. And so, and to have your teacher, your spiritual teacher, say, go kill this goose wherever you can, where no one's going to see you. So the first one came, the first student comes back months later and says, I went over hill and valley, and I finally found this place where there was no one around and no living beings around, and I killed the goose. Said, okay, you're out. You're fired, right? Isn't that like that? And the second one went over hill and dale and also comes back with a dead goose. And years later, like a year later, the third student is still missing in action, and the teacher's waiting and waiting. And finally he comes back with a goose under his arm, living, breathing, eating, pooping goose. And he says, no matter where I went, the goose could still see me. It's also in the Sufi traditions also some that wherever I went, God could still see me. And what the Buddhists would say is wherever I went, the karma recorder could still see me. That's still going in an imprint in my mind. I could still see me. Right? So the question is then, how do I plant positive karmic seeds going forward? How do I avoid negative? That we get into really when we talk about ethics. So I think the thing to understand that really works in our lives is to begin to see that everything that we are experiencing now comes from karmic seeds we planted in the past. We don't beat ourselves up on it, about it. We understand that that's dry cement, right? We can't work with that. What we can work with is going forward. So we treat ourselves with kindness, and we immediately try to plant the opposite kind of seed. So if I have a lot of people that are angry with me at work, it means I've been angry with people maybe unfairly. And to be honest, this is taking radical responsibility for our lives, right? And the more that we do that, the more freedom we have going forward. Because every time the responsibility and the buck stops here, then we're not giving power away out there to something that's outside our control. So I see, okay, what I need to do whenever I see anything negative in my life, what I need to do is start looking like, where am I planting that seed currently so it doesn't go forward? And it isn't about denying our feelings or needs. It's about how do we then work with them skillfully, right, going forward. Often we plant negative seeds because we're not in touch with our underlying feelings and needs. And so we act out, we get reactive, we experience a charge. So to stop the ones that we don't want to see in the future and start planning what we want to see. And the biggest way to do it is to really think about, okay, what do I want in my life in the future? Think about someone else to give that to. Do it, and then rejoice about having done it. Right? Those are kind of the four steps. And I've gone way over our usual halfway break. But how does that land? Like a quick check-in. Do you have something to add? No? Okay. So let's take a break and chew on that, but not the pen. And we will come back in 10 minutes. Thank you.
Can we turn down the man because I was creating this noise?
Yeah, good idea.
Turn it off.
Turn it off.